It's fun to have a vision, and it's even more fun when you can make it come to life. Stay tuned. Good afternoon. I'm Chrissa Hewitt. Issues and Ideas continues now with Ears on Art, a twice-monthly program that Stephen DeLuque and I put together here at the studios of KCBX Public Radio for the California Central Coast. Today, we continue our conversation with artist and teacher Barry Franz. Last week, we learned that his primary material is clay, which he has used throwing on the wheel and also for sculpture. The avenues of sculpture then expanded through his work of developing a bronze foundry on the Cuesta campus. Today we learn about how that program was developed and also some fun history of how the art department started out in the bungalows on the backside of campus. Although he retired a few years ago, it is easy to hear in his voice that Barry has a real place in his heart for the art department at Cuesta College. Here now is part two of our conversation with artist, teacher, Barry Franz. Talking about Cuesta more and more, and you made reference to the development of the foundry. You had the ceramics department going, and Chet was teaching painting and some drawing. You're trying to expand and get to develop actually physical space so that you can start doing sculpture?
I think it was in 1972 that the board, back before Prop 13, had a little more money, a little more discretionary funds, and they actually paid for this extension, which was above and beyond what the state had budgeted for the basic art department. So we got this wonderful sculpture facility added on to the original art building, and that's when I was able to start working over there developing that program. And it was John Osborne that we brought down from San Jose State, who was a technician there in their founding program, and he did a summer workshop. We built the primitive facility on our own with using, rusty plumbing and used bricks, and it never would have passed OSHA, but we got a foundry going, and fortunately no one was injured. And then we gradually replaced that as much as we could. Well, eventually it's all been replaced with modern, high-tech automatic ignitions and automatic shutdown and all the safety equipment.
You know what is needed in a foundry, but a lot of people don't. So this is a foundry for casting bronze, right, for the most part. So walk us through what some of the basic facilities need to be for that.
We do lost wax, so there has to be a facility for melting down the microcrystalline wax, which is a residue from the petroleum refining process. So we have an area for working wax, melting it, and pouring it out in sheets, which then is cut and welded with soldering irons and modeling when it's warm. That's the way you make the artwork. You have to have a wax original. That then has to be encased in refractory material, primarily plaster and sand, and gated so it, the metal can eventually funnel into that area once that wax is evacuated. It's called the lost wax process because the wax is evacuated by heating it in a kiln. A ceramic kiln, but it has to be a huge kiln because these investments, especially when you have several students working, adds up to quite an amount of material. So we have this huge kiln with a wheel out floor, so we can load the stuff up, push it in, and then you heat it slowly, very slowly, bring it up to temperature around 1100 degrees, and hold it there till all that wax has been flushed and burned. And then as it cools, you have to start preparing the bronze. And that requires a melting furnace, which heats the bronze to around 2,200 degrees, which is really hot. You need all this protective gear, reflective and insulated material and big steel tongs and tools to lift the crucible out full of bronze. In the meantime, the investments are unloaded from the kiln, buried in sand, you have a sand pit that has to be shoveled out. I don't know how many times I've shoveled that sand out. And then you put the pieces, shovel the sand back. Careful not to get any sand inside the cavity where the bronze is. And then that hot bronze is poured in. The sand is there to reinforce it because the pressure of that hot bronze could cause it to fracture, and that's not good. Have 2,200 degree bronze running around on the floor. It's a beautiful process.
It is.
It has to be done very carefully. Once you get the bronze poured, you're halfway done. Then you got to knock this thing apart, pull it out and see what you got, and then start cutting off the excess sprues and grinding and polishing and patinating. And it's a long process, very laborious, hard on the knuckles, hard on the back, but it's beautiful.
I took this class 4 or 5 times at least and was there in the very early stages when John came. And it's really an amazing facility. We have some other bronze casting professional facilities in this county that you can take a model to and have them cast it for you. But to my knowledge, this is the only school facility in a lot of places where you can go and actually learn how to do this.
Santa Barbara City College and San Jose. UC Santa Barbara foundry was shut down when that faculty person left. San Jose City College has a good program, but between there and San Jose, we're the only place where you can actually get involved and participate.
We talk about heavy lifting and tiresome, dirty, sweaty work, and you talk about plaster and sand being mixed together to make this investment that encases the wax. I always loved the term lost wax casting. It made it sound like some ancient something.
Sounds
out of,
mysterious.
You know, whatever.
Like a lost continent.
Exactly. When I was out there, we were using leftover sand and plaster as part of the mix. So you'd have fresh sand, fresh plaster, and what did they call the other stuff?
I don't remember.
Okay. Well,
we had to grind it.
We had to grind it. We had to use heavy bars with plates on the end and try to stamp it. We'd, you know, see if somebody had a pickup truck that could come in and run over it for a while, and you'd try to get this stuff down to be pulverized so that you could mix it. And it was like, oh.
Really high tech.
High tech, and hey.
You know, it's because materials are cheaper here than labor. If you have cheap labor, they still use that. Mm-hmm. One of the visiting artists who had been in Italy, he said, you know, they're still using some of the same material that Michelangelo used. They just keep re-grinding it.
I don't doubt it. But now I believe at Cuesta they're using a process called a shell. It's a little different method of encasing the wax.
That's a thin-walled ceramic shell, and it's very hard. It still has to be rammed up in sand to protect it. But I never got into that because it takes all day to build up one of those. And we have to get this done, you know, within the period of the class. And the plaster, you pour it in, you're done. That takes all day long. You also have this problem with silica dust flying around, and we didn't have a proper facility to evacuate all that dust. And I thought, it's not healthy. It takes too long. And the advantage is that it gives very precise detail. But it's also so hard. If you have any undercuts on the surface of your wax, it gets embedded in the bronze eventually, and you can't get it out. So I never was that keen on it. It's an industrial process. It was invented for making bronze propellers for submarines. It's a very precise thing, and industrially it has great application, and for some art. Well, especially if you make the art with a mold. If your wax is generated from a mold, by definition, there you have no undercuts, or the mold won't come off. So if you're making your wax original with a mold, of course, then it's not original, it's a multiple. And I always encourage making of unique pieces, one-offs. So there was a lot of conflict in my mind about whether this was the thing to do. And it was mainly the health thing and the time issue that I decided made it impractical for a studio application at Cuesta College. But most places do it. I don't know how they solve the problem. Well, I've seen it done pretty badly, actually. I think we did the right thing by doing the standard plaster investment. It's safer.
And it's except on your back.
Well, it's heavy. It's darn right. Yeah, I had a back operation right after I retired.
Since I own a jewelry store downtown, we send off our platinum casting pieces because it just requires so much heavy machinery and high temperatures and things like that. And they use porcelain casts for the platinum casting, the company that we send it to, because the platinum will just blow out plaster.
The jewelry casting is just a miniature version of what we do large. Mm-hmm. And I did that in college, too, although we used some dental plaster, or it's a high temperature plaster, but it's a very similar process.
Mm-hmm. Well, the interesting thing is how those three disciplines, the dental industry and sculpture and the jewelry industry, all have this connection. Mm-hmm. And the dental industry needed, of course, very precise castings. Thing had to fit in the hole that they had carved. So what happens in the process is, if you're basically just making a piece of jewelry, there's a considerable amount of shrinkage. So they were developing investments with certain kinds of plaster and stuff to try to really minimize that amount of shrinking, and also, of course, to keep the detail. And then they were also, as I understood it, developing waxes with much lower carbon content, so they would burn out cleaner, so that you had fewer pits and all of that kind of stuff. Here again, we go back to the balance, and we've got the industrial world. And obviously, if you're making a propeller for a submarine, you don't want to be sitting there trying to pour an investment around it if you're much of any of us. So you can certainly see why people are coming up with alternatives.
You're listening to Ears on Art, a segment of Issues and Ideas. Our guest today is Barry Franz, artist specializing in clay and sculpture, and quite importantly, the second faculty member hired for the art department at Cuesta College. We have been discussing Barry's development of the department's bronze foundry. We continue now as we discuss how some of this works, and then take a trip down memory lane of the beginning days of the art department.
The way that that class was taught, I also thought was very helpful, which was basically an all-day Friday. I mean, you got out there at 9 in the morning or 8, and you worked all day. And, of course, you were working behind the scenes, firing the pieces for a couple of days before that so that we could pour if we were ready that day. But in the meantime, we were working wax and investing. And I remember one particularly cold day, and we're sitting in the wax working room, and everybody's kind of wishing that they were someplace else. And you kind of stormed in and went, "Come on, folks, this is wax. It's not a slab of marble. Just get in there and, you know, get it warm. Put it in some hot water. Do something." And it was just kind of like, "Oh, thank you."
You can make a mistake and correct it easily.
It was saying, this is a material that you can be much freer with than you're trying to be in terms of exploring texture, exploring all sorts of ways of bending that almost quarter-inch sheet of wax, which is certainly pliable, but if it gets hard, it doesn't bend as easily.
Temperature is critical.
Mm-hmm. You know, here we were cutting and assembling as though it were cardboard, and Barry comes in and goes, "Hey!
Stick it in the hot water." Temperature is critical. You know, wax can either crack or it can melt. You've got to control the temperature. When you try to weld something together, if it's too warm, it'll just fall off. If it's too cold, you'll never get it stuck. You got to work with the temperature. And it's like with ceramic, it's the water content you have to worry about, whether it's too hard or too soft or whether it's going to join or fall apart. With wax, it's temperature.
And the other fun thing about that was, if we're talking about making connections to other disciplines and processes, when we were pouring those sheets, then exploring what happened if on this slab of plaster that we could pour wax onto and made a little lip around it so it would be the right thickness, that you could carve detail into that and the wax would go into those details and then give you a sheet that had texture. But of course, that sheet was now a reverse texture of what you had.
It's kind of like printmaking.
Exactly. So, you know, it comes off the reverse and now we have dimension to it. So what was a hole in the plaster is now a projection coming up in the wax. And so that was a fun thing to explore too, in terms of having to think backwards.
These are all things that you don't get if you're thinking of mold making, you know. So many people make a sculpture out of whatever material they're comfortable with, but the bronze is simply a mold taken off of that and replicated in bronze, but they don't get to experience the wax, which is something which is very pliable and tactile and has all kinds of possibilities once you explore its own potential.
Makes your hands soft after a while, too, at least that stuff, because it certainly, as you say, is a petroleum-based material. So how many years now has that program been going? Because to my knowledge, it's still going pretty strong, isn't it?
Well, when I started there in 67, Chet had this funky little kill outside the old mess hall, which was the sculpture room. And I taught it out there one semester, and I thought, this is too dangerous. I'm not going to do this anymore. And so we quit, and it wasn't until we moved into the new building, and I believe it was 1972, that we built the new foundry. And it's been going all along ever since. I keep worrying about it being shut down. People think it's very expensive to operate, but then when they look at the cost of the heating of the whole facility, it's minimal. It's very little compared to the operating of the facility as a whole. So it's still alive. I think they still support us. They recognize it as a very fine art department, appreciated and supported by the community. And it's a good public relations instrument for the school.
You're talking about the old Camp San Luis buildings.
Yeah.
That was across the creek from where the current campus is, and I think you might want to explain about that. These are old World War II barracks buildings that you guys were using.
Yeah, back then it was pretty rustic. They were old concrete slabs with wooden structures that were already condemned, I think, when we moved in, but we continued to teach in them for a long time.
You and the termites.
And the termites, yeah. The ceramics room had a space heater overhead that was blowing on the back of my neck, and often I would be standing in water in the wintertime. It would just flood. It was an old men's latrine, and they took out one row of toilets and put in the pottery wheels, left one latrine in the back. Had a little overhang, a little shed on the back where we put a kill, and there was a big old sink where we could do the glazing and all. It was really rustic, but, you know, it was so free. Well, we did things that we could never do today. We went down to Lompoc and bought a whole bunch of second diatomaceous earth bricks that they were manufacturing down there. In fact, they gave them to us. And for years, we would build kills and tear them down just as a class project. And we would plumb them with old used galvanized pipe that we'd find, you know, over in the maintenance yard that they'd ripped up somewhere. Build our own burners. The students learned at that time how a kiln worked. Now it's all so high tech. I don't know what's going on. It was a lot of fun, really a lot of fun. Strangely enough, I met a guy up in the Sierras at the top of Mono Pass and started talking to him. It turned out he was a CCC guy, instructor, and he said, oh, he taught in San Luis Obispo. The building that we had as a sculpture lab was his building when he was there. All those art buildings now have been replastered, and they're being reused current usages, including the County Historical Society uses the old office and the ceramics building as their warehouse, and I don't know what all they do in there, but it's all plastered and connected with a wing between the two. Those buildings are getting a lot of use.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say, some of the nonprofits are out there too. Some of the like court-supported nonprofit agencies have offices in those buildings now as well.
Well, I think it still belongs to the National Guard, mm-hmm. and they lease them or rent them at a very reasonable rate. I think that's how Cuesta got going. They leased all that stuff very cheaply, but they bought somehow the property from the creek out to the highway and knocked down all those buildings and built a new campus that's still surrounded by National Guard, mm-hmm. which is kind of strange sometimes. So. When the students rioted in Santa Barbara or Isla Vista and burned the Bank of America. Mm-hmm. I went out to Cuesta the next morning, and there were machine gun placements in the entrances to the campus and concertina wire between the military base and the campus. It was like they knew that we were going to riot and do something.
When I first arrived at Poly, the ceramic program was out at the edge of the baseball field. Mm-hmm. So they would have balls coming into the area, and so they would scrounge and put up screen to keep that from happening, and then they were building the glass facility out there. But it definitely was a different kind of time because the maintenance crews had a different kind of freedom to just kind of mill around campus and get to know people. And we have a whole pile of bricks over there that are just, do you want some? You could make a flooring. Whoa, okay. There was a lot of kind of wonderful scrounging, and I had the feeling that probably that was happening for you at Cuesta as well, in terms of just, as you say, building as you go and making something work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, we knocked the wall out of the end of the ceramic room and put in some old windows we found stored over by the maintenance room and lit that place up so you could see what's going on in there. Yeah. And somebody brought it up at the Board of Trustees meeting once, and I think it was Vard Luma said, could you come over and do some remodeling on my house? And we had those funny things they called hatmans. They had all these little things that were for bunks. They were about 10 by 10. Mm-hmm. They were scads of those things. And they were selling them to people all around the county. And they're still out in the ranches as sheds and stuff. And we had eight of them put in a circle or a quad behind the ceramics room. And so we had studio spaces out there for people who wanted to do some big sculpture. We had the plaster room out there, so it's kept separate from the ceramic room. I had one out there. I could go out and work. It was wonderful. I'd get the students all set up in the classroom and said, all right, I'm right outside. Mm-hmm. Come out and watch, talk. It was great. It was just wonderful. You don't have that kind of flexibility anymore.
I think the building that was used as a lecture hall, the little theater, used as their location for about 8 years back in... Well, it would be probably the 80s, the early to mid-80s. They set up their theater out there.
I took that class, too, so I learned how to make sets and stuff. That was kind of fun. I grew up across the street from the old Republic Studios that filmed all the movies and stuff, and so we would see the facades of streets. Mm-hmm. It was kind of fun learning some of the tricks of that trade. So now you're retired. And you've got a studio here, so is most of your time spent just kind of having fun with that or anything other special, still off traveling?
And off and on. I don't push it. I haven't found a venue around here which is really appropriate for the kind of stuff I do, and I'm not one to hustling down to L.A. and up to the Bay Area. So I make what I'm interested in making, but the scale has gotten smaller. Space is a premium. All my cupboards and things are full of artwork now. So I make stuff, but I also have an addiction to fixing up old Alfa Romeos, so there's usually one of those around taking up space. I started doing photography, abstract kind of compositions as I go out and hike. I hike a lot, and I take the camera along and take shots of water reflections and stone patterns and things. Not really landscapes, but... Oh, I stay busy, yeah. I used to do all my own house maintenance, although I'm getting kind of tired of that. It's sort of getting impossible anymore. But when we did this house, I did all the finish work and built a lot of the custom features in myself. So I've been busy.
Amazing. It doesn't seem to take much to fill up the days. And I think that one is very fortunate if one has something one loves to do. Retirement is only retiring in terms of that formal job.
It's not like going to bed. In fact, most people I know, they find themselves busier once they retire than when they were working. They'd put so many things aside. It's so much to catch up on. They just can't believe how busy they are, but how enjoyable it is, too.
Do you and Barbara get to travel?
I've traveled all my life, and we've traveled together a lot. Last year, it was our 50th wedding anniversary, and we did a formal tour over to the El Camino de Santiago de Compostela and did a real leisurely walk of a section of that road with four-star hotels and a big fat bus to make sure we got where we were going and got back to the hotel. It was wonderful. It was really wonderful. Great food. And we went to Sweden and bought a Volvo there, took possession of a Volvo there as part of that trip. I've been to every damn place, just about. Traveling third class, hitchhiking. You know, I got one sabbatical to travel around the world to study the non-Western arts that I'd been teaching out of a book. And that was a great adventure in 1993. I brought back lots of slides, lots of experiences, and a lot of artwork resulted from that experience. Those sabbaticals are just wonderful opportunities to enrich your life and enrich your teaching, what you're giving to the students. We're talking about going to Quebec this next year, maybe. Someplace we haven't been and different than where we've been, so we're still thinking of travel.
I'll recommend the Canadian train.
Yeah?
Great way to get there.
It's just awfully nice right here. You know, it's always nice to come back to San Luis Obispo. It makes it harder to leave. You know, that when you come back, it'll be better than where you went.
I have to keep reminding myself that people actually pay money to come here on vacation.
Exactly. Yeah, we're so fortunate.
Well, Barry, we're really going to look forward to seeing this exhibit, all three of them, as a matter of fact. And we had a nice time interviewing Chet Amix and his wife, Gyla Amix. We'll talk to Bob Pelfrey and round out the trio.
I appreciate your interest because I think we were a significant impact out there at the school and on the community, laid the groundwork, and great people have followed and continue to build the program. It's been a good life.
I think you're accurate on that one, so thank you very much.
Thank you, Krissa. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you very much.
Our guest this week and last has been Barry Franz, retired professor from the Cuesta Art Department. Next month, we will have a two-part conversation with another of the faculty, Bob Pelfrey. Here is co-host Stephen DeLuque to explain the timing for these two interviews.
Barry, along with Chet Amix and Bob Pelfrey, are being honored with shows at the Cuesta College Art Gallery to coincide with the 50th anniversary of the founding of Cuesta College. Chet Amix's show is currently running through September 20th. Barry Franz's show is September 27th through October 11th. And Bob Pelfrey's show runs October 18th through November 8th. The gallery, which is located on the Cuesta College campus, is open Monday through Friday, noon to 4 p.m.
It probably won't come as a huge surprise that due to many budget cutbacks, the gallery, too, is struggling. Faculty and students under the direction of David Prochaska are working overtime to make it all happen. Fortunately, the Cuesta Foundation has been willing to set up a separate account just for the gallery. If you're interested in details about this, please contact either the Cuesta Art Department or the Cuesta Foundation. This month has been Barry Franz. Next month is Bob Pelfrey. And no, we did not forget Chet Amix. If you go to the KCBX archives under Ears on Art for May 2nd and 9th, 2012, you can listen to our interview with Chet and his wife, Gyla. You have been listening to Ears on Art here on KCBX Public Radio. I am Krissa Hewitt, and on behalf of my co-host, Stephen DeLuque, want to thank you so much for listening.